Hi, I'm Bruce Barber, and in this week's Yale Cancer Center Answers, our hosts, Dr. Edward Chu and Dr. Ken Miller, will discuss cancer survivorship. Dr. Chu is the Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and is a leading expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller, a medical oncologist, is the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic at Yale Cancer Center. Yale Cancer Center Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care every Sunday evening on WNPR. Doctors Chu and Miller welcome some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. They want to provide you with help and hope from the Yale Cancer Center, and they are available to answer your questions. If you'd like to submit a question about cancer to the show, please email your question to canceranswers@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC, and they'll answer your questions on a future show. If you're interested in listening to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers, or if you'd like to learn more about specific kinds of cancer, all the shows are posted in audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. This evening, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will discuss cancer survivorship. Today, the first Sunday in June, is National Cancer Survivors Day, a day dedicated to celebrating life and cancer survivorship. There are over 11 million cancer survivors in the United States, and today we celebrate all of them. And in recognition of Cancer Survivors Day, Drs. Chu and Miller are joined by Dr. Julia Rowland. Dr. Rowland is director of the Office of Cancer Survivorship at the National Cancer Institute. And we start with Ken Miller.
Julia, let's start out by talking about the definition. Who is a cancer survivor?
You know, that's a wonderful question to ask. For many years, leading up until the end of the last century even, the medical definition of a cancer survivor was somebody who had been disease-free for 5 years. So you couldn't be labeled or call yourself or consider yourself a survivor until you'd passed that benchmark. But as the number of individuals who were living long-term with the disease increased, a very important event happened. In 1986, a group of 24 individuals met in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and formed what would now be called the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship. And at that very important meeting, they looked at that definition and said, you know, it's not okay to wait 5 years to think of yourself as a survivor for two reasons. One, we need to provide that message, as you said, of hope for individuals who are diagnosed that they have a future ahead of them. But more importantly, we need to let the medical community know that they have to be thinking about our lives at the moment of diagnosis. So they decided that they needed to reframe that definition and that individuals could call themselves a survivor from the day of diagnosis and for the balance of their life.
I want to follow up on one of the points you just made. Why did they feel, and why do you feel it's important to embrace that term from the moment of diagnosis as opposed to later on?
The reason they said that it was important to have that point in time designated as the one where you could call yourself a survivor is because we know that important decisions need to be made before treatment starts. You can't wait 5 years to decide, gee, I'd love to have family, and then realize that you've had a treatment that has caused you to become infertile. Or if you are an athlete and there is a decision about an amputation, could you spare a limb? You need to be able to make those decisions at the time of diagnosis so that you can have that quality of life later. So for the coalition, their message was very important. We need to be able to provide that dialogue right from the start of treatment.
I've heard that now the cancer survivorship definition has even been broadened from 5 years to the day that they've been diagnosed to actually also include the loved ones, the support caregivers, et cetera. Maybe you could expand on that a little bit?
Ed, absolutely. When the coalition met back in 1986, now 20 years ago, they included under the umbrella of that definition family members because we know that cancer is an illness that affects not just the individual but also that person's family and that they are very important in the recovery process and in the survivorship trajectory, if you like. So they felt it was important to acknowledge that role and to include them in that definition.
And it's interesting, if you take that broader definition of cancer survivor, the numbers actually are much more impressive than the 11 million figure that we started off the show. And I think I've read, in fact, on the NCI website that it's estimated that perhaps 3 out of every 4 individuals in this country could, in fact, be considered a cancer survivor.
Well, the American Cancer Society has estimated that 3 out of every 4 families will have an affected member. So when you start doing the math around that, you're right. If we look around a gathering of 100 people, many of those individuals will either be a survivor, him or herself, or be a loved one or caregiver. And if you think even more broadly of all the people that are important to survivors across their illness, it could be friends, it's neighbors, it's their community. So this is an illness that really does affect millions and millions and millions of people.
Julie, I want to ask you a little bit sort of about the history of this movement, because, I mean, you know, the concept of survivorship is relatively new. Can you tell us more about it?
We know for a long time, certainly when the Cancer Act was passed in 1971, the picture was fairly bleak for individuals who had a diagnosis of cancer. Most individuals were not going to outlive their illness. We had few treatment options. There were The side effects were poorly controlled. It was not a pretty time for individuals diagnosed with this history. But as we got better treatments, newer technologies to find cancers early, and that population of survivors began to grow, that recognition of individuals that their life goes on after cancer allowed the clinical community to begin to take a look at what is the impact of treating and curing somebody or controlling this disease. And that community, our survivor population, has been incredibly compellingly articulate and vocal about their needs.
And along those lines, what are cancer survivors telling us?
What cancer survivors are telling us are several things. First and foremost, if we look at all the literature combined, the research that's been done to date, and I would highlight the fact what's really critical is that we would not have this information if literally thousands of survivors hadn't been willing to take the time to talk about their experience, share it with the medical community and researchers, fill out our questionnaires and forms. So if somebody asks you, please will you fill out these forms? Mm-hmm. I hope you'll volunteer to do it because it's making a difference in people's lives. But what we find when we look at that literature as a whole is that survivors are telling us two things. One, most individuals, despite the demand of treatment and the toxicities of some of these therapies, the arduous course, are incredibly resilient. They muster the resources they need to get through this. They do a remarkable job of that. It's very impressive time and again how people can tell us they got through it. But what they're also telling us is when treatment's over, the illness experience is not over. It ain't over when it's over is what we're hearing time and again. Cancer can affect all aspects of an individual's life, from the physical to the emotional to the social to the existential, if you like. And it's those issues that they struggle with and which the medical community is still lagging behind in helping us systematically address.
Yeah, I have to say, you raise a very good point, Julia, because I know when I was a fellow and I trained at the National Cancer Institute many, many moons ago, you know, we focused on the treatment aspects. And I have to say, we really didn't focus on kind of what happened once the individual, you know, finished and completed their therapy and what were the consequences of that therapy. And it's nice to see now that I know in our own fellowship program, we're really now beginning to try to develop programs that incorporate that aspect.
Our growing population of survivors is a wonderful testament to all of the research that individuals like you have done to help us advance our ability to cure and control cancer. But they're also a challenge to us. They say, that's great, but to what are you returning us? What is our life going to be like? You need to ensure that you're going to give us a life of value in the context of having had this illness. So that's a very important message back to the medical community.
And I think one of the good things about all of the large clinical trials that are now being conducted, that their quality of life indices that are now being incorporated.
Absolutely. And that's the focus in part why we created the Office of Cancer Survivorship, is to increase the visibility of science in that area and to promote recognition of the need to have not just, you know, recurrence and disease indicators, but also personal indicators of the impact of this illness on an individual's life.
Later on in the program, I think we can talk about some of the challenges that survivors face, physical, emotional, et cetera. But what are some of the positive things that they report as being a cancer survivor?
You know, for so long we were focused on all the ways that we had damaged individuals, caused them disability, disfigurement, distress. And all of our research was really focused on that. Tell us all the problems you've had with it. But as researchers stood back and began to listen to survivors, they would say, you know, doc, These have been problems for me, but what surprised me was I was able to do this. I'm pretty proud of the fact that I was able to get through this disease. I was able to tolerate treatments I didn't think I could get through. And more importantly, you know, I really appreciate the life I have now, this sort of sense of what researchers call post-traumatic growth, but it's, in a sense, this kind of benefit finding, the way that we're wired to make sense of traumatic experiences in our lives, but also to find that silver lining, to, you know, stop and smell the roses, to appreciate the people who've been there for you, to live each day more fully and more deeply. That has been, for many individuals, an incredible, in some cases, surprise, but that sort of gift, if you like, that comes with a serious illness like cancer.
And is that the same for the family, for the caregivers, or is their process different?
Well, you know, the processes are different, but family members' responses often parallel those of their loved one who's the actual patient. And sometimes family members have an even more difficult time because, of course, all of our intent in the medical community is to help the individuals in active treatment. And we kind of take for granted that family members are there, but we don't offer consistent help to them. We are often focused so much on the patient that we're not looking at family. And yet they're going through the same kinds of experience with less support. So that's a really good question, and I think what we need is more research, too, to help us identify what are the critical information needs, support needs that family members have so that they can be there and do as well as the patient, him or herself.
Julie, I want to ask you about some of the you had mentioned essentially the multiple challenges people face, physical, social, emotional, existential. What are the – tell us about the existential ones. I think it's an interesting concept.
Well, you know, those words, you have cancer, are probably some of the most terrifying that individuals hear in a lifetime. And what it often raises for each individual, depending on the nature of that discussion, is, am I going to be alive? Is this going to kill me? Is this going to be it? Is my life over? And for many individuals, that's not something they've thought about. It does bring to the fore, why am I here? What's going to happen? What's the future going to be like? Causing people to really do that life review and come to terms with, what is this all about? Why do I have this disease? How do I make sense of this? And what do I want to do differently if I go forward with life after this treatment is over and if I survive it?
And I also wanted to ask, too, about if you can tell us a little bit about some of the physical challenges people face. Obviously, these are very important ones that people deal with.
The physical challenges of cancer are vast in many ways, again, depending on the nature of the treatment and the type of cancer, but they can literally affect every organ system, every component of an individual's functioning. Some people have very few effects, some people have many, and it's very difficult for us to predict who's going to have what kinds of problems. But to give you an example of some of these, clearly if you have surgery, there's surgical scarring, changes in body image, capacity to do things based on the nature of the surgery. We're beginning to see, as we listen to survivors recover from these illnesses, some persistent or chronic problems. The most commonly reported problem that we hear about is fatigue. I just don't have the energy I used to have. I'm dragging around the house. This is going on for months. When is this going to be over? Doesn't respond to taking naps. I just want to have that energy back. Lymphedema, common problem for our breast cancer survivors and survivors who've had other kinds of dissections of their lymph node systems. Cognitive problems. I can't remember anything, this chemo brain or chemo fog that so many of our patients talk to us about. I can't concentrate. I can't do all the multitasking I used to do. That's problematic for me. Sexual dysfunction, also another one, very common but often unaddressed. You know, this is some of these hidden symptoms that we do worry about because the medical team doesn't ask. The patient is reluctant to bring this up. So these don't get aired, some of the very important kinds of issues. And the final category in here, issues like depression, anxiety, fear of recurrence that's going to come back, so this can have physiologic manifestations, and pain syndromes. We're seeing a variety of new persistent pain syndromes that really warrant more attention.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to yalecanceranswers@yale.edu, or you can call 1-888-234-4YCC. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about cancer survivorship with Dr. Julia Rowland from the National Cancer Institute.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2007 there will be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country. 2,400 patients diagnosed annually right here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. However, patients with advanced melanoma now have more hope than ever before. Each day, patients are surviving the disease due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's only federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center on the web at yalecancercenter.org.
Julia, I think it's a wonderful opportunity on Cancer Survivorship Day to ask you, what is the Office of Cancer Survivorship?
So glad you asked, Ken. It's very important for everybody who's listening today to know about this office because this is your public entity, if you like. It's an office that was established within the National Cancer Institute in 1996 in specific recognition of the growing population of survivors and their very unique and at that time poorly understood set of needs. The office was designed in direct response to really articulate and compelling advocacy from the consumer community, from survivors saying, you know, it's wonderful that we have all of these medical advances allowing people to live longer with cancer, but we need to know more about the lives of those individuals once treatment is over. So the office's main mission is really to enhance not just the quality of life of individuals, but also the length of that survival, and also by educating the scientific community as well as the public about what we're finding out in this area. So I welcome the opportunity to be here today to be able to share some of that information.
And what resources through your office are available to the public? How would they learn more about survivorship?
That's a terrific question, and certainly one of the ways they can find out more information if someone's interested in what the office is doing, your office, I like to say, to the public, is we do have a website that individuals can visit, and that can be accessed by www.survivorship.cancer.gov. So that's survivorship.cancer.gov. So you can find out what we're funding, the kind of research we have, resources available to patients and family members on that site, or links to those. So that's certainly one way to find out more about the office. And in collaboration with our educational partners at the National Cancer Institute, we also have put out a publication series called Facing Forward. It's a wonderful set of booklets that talks about what are the issues that individuals face as they're finishing cancer treatment and resuming their normal lives. It's a set right now of several different books. One is Life After Cancer Treatment that's in English and in Spanish. We have another one that's specifically for caregivers when your loved one is finishing treatment. And we have a third book that's really designed to help people who've been through this experience think about ways that they may want to get involved in another level in their cancer experience. We call it Ways to Make a Difference in Cancer, Ways to Give Back. Because many survivors have told us, you know, I've been through this experience. I want to help others or reach out to others who may be struggling with this because I think I can help them or I can think I can improve their outcomes. So that's a wonderful resource suggesting ways that you could do that to get involved again in the larger cancer effort.
Julie, maybe just to take a step back and you know, ask about your own experience and how did you get into this whole field of cancer survivorship?
Gee, that's an interesting question, and it's a funny journey, and I'm not sure how to make it pithy and succinct. In some ways, I have been in the cancer arena, ironically, from very early on. I started out in the field of what's called cytology, so I was actually interested in cellular biology. I trained up in a technical area called cytotechnology. So for the lay person, I'm trained to read pap smears, among other things. I'll look at cellular diagnosis of cancer. So I kind of started in that area. But as I worked in cytology, I realized that I was much more interested in people and decided to go back to school and graduate work in psychology. And I was doing some of my doctoral work at Columbia University and took a course by a visiting faculty member from Harvard who was very interested in what are called the sort of psychosomatic disorders, job demands, worker stress, and its impact on individuals' health. And I fell into the literature from the 1950s and 60s looking at, was there a type C, a cancer personality? I got very interested in that. I'll tell you right away, there is no such thing as a cancer personality. It's a very egalitarian disease, I'm sorry to say. We're all potential candidates for developing cancer, so I don't think there's a particular risk profile in that regard. But that course led me to work that was being done by a woman at that time in New York City named Jimmy Holland, who was really the pioneer of what we now call the field of psycho-oncology or psychosocial oncology. And I ended up doing research work with her, and that was kind of the beginning of my career.
And in fact, as we talked, I guess, in the last segment, much of cancer survivorship really does deal with the psychosocial, emotional, cognitive, existential issues.
I would say that's true. It's not that we aren't very attentive to those long-term and late medical or physiologic sequelae, but, you know, we are an integrated system. So if you have a physiologic problem, it's going to have an emotional, cognitive, social impact here, and vice versa. So if we're depressed, it has physiologic ramifications, and we have to be dealing with both of those. And sometimes it's easier to access and change things on the psychosocial level than it is on the physical, and yet we could probably affect change on the physical level by doing things in the behavioral arena. So it's an interesting area in which to be functioning right now.
In terms of the mind-body connection in survivorship, you know, what's the research telling us?
Well, you know, this is a growing area of interest of looking at that mind-body connect. So if you, let's take depression for an example, if you were depressed, what is the impact on that on your survival? And there's certainly data to suggest that if you're hopeless and helpless and you're giving up and you don't feel there's anything you can do about your illness, that is a risk factor for doing poorly and for having a poor disease outcome. So we are concerned at how do we intervene. And then the more interesting biologic question becomes, well, if you alter the depression, what are you altering biochemically for that individual? So what's the interface in here? And as I said, sometimes our behavioral changes, the way we help people think about their illness, reframing it, if you like, saying, yes, this is a challenge, but it's a one you can surmount. There is help to be had to be thinking about the things that might benefit you in your recovery, can help people get through what could be potentially very challenging situations.
Julia, turning back to kind of the overall mission of your office, does your office and does the National Cancer Institute have special expectations for the designated comprehensive cancer centers? And I'm proud to say that the Yale Cancer Center was just recently reapproved for the 5-year term, if you will, as a National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer center.
You're right. Yale has actually had 33 years of being a designated comprehensive cancer center. It's a remarkable record, so that's an important resource for the larger Connecticut population. But the Cancer Institute is very committed to this area. The fact that we have an Office of Cancer Survivorship says something right away, and we just celebrated the decennial of that office, and remarkable progress has been made in our capacity to grow the science in this arena. We also know that through the National Cancer Institute leadership, there's been a focus and an emphasis on the incorporation at the comprehensive centers of this aspect of what we call the cancer control arena, that they are now looking to the comprehensive centers to pick up on this area of research and care as one that they need to own and they need to champion. And in fact, very recently, the cancer center directors, of the directors of all of these 37-some plus comprehensive centers across the United States, put together a report in which they detailed what they were doing in the survivorship arena. It's quite a remarkable document, in fact, saying all the different services and programs and research that they are now pursuing addressing cancer survivorship.
So, overall, what types of services are being provided throughout the United States? How many programs are there, and what do they do?
Well, that's a good question, too, Ken. The emphasis now on sort of developing programs, in particular for individuals that they're making that transition to post-treatment, if you like, there's a new set of initiatives, in part supported by the Lance Armstrong Foundation, which has been very instrumental in bringing attention to this area of need and care. There are now a small number and a growing number of comprehensive centers that have these survivorship programs. programs that are specifically designed, like the one, Ken, that you're leading and that we'll hear a little bit more about later, that are designed to help individuals map out the course of their health and their well-being after the active treatment period. So these are fairly new activities, at least in the adult arena. In the pediatric arena, we actually have seen much more activity in this because our pediatric cancer survivors have really been in the vanguard of our understanding of long-term survivorship issues, because some of the most dramatic successes we've had in curing cancer have really come among these younger survivors.
Kind of picking up on Julia's point, I'm proud to say that I think we here at the Yale Cancer Center are very committed to the whole issue of cancer survivorship. And for those of you who are not aware out there in the listening audience, my co-host, Dr. Ken Miller, is in fact the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic here at Yale. Ken, maybe you can just tell our listeners out there a little bit about what this survivorship clinic is all about, and perhaps also let people know what the Connecticut Challenge represents.
Sure, my pleasure. We started a program approximately 6 months ago to offer to cancer survivors an opportunity to in a sense process the experience and to start moving on to the next phase of survivorship beyond the active treatment. There's certain needs that people have when they're first diagnosed, when they're being treated, but we're really trying to meet their needs afterwards. So our patients, our cancer survivors, come. They meet with a nurse practitioner who talks about wellness and screening and being healthy. They see a nutritionist to talk about healthy diet and healthy lifestyles. They meet with a physical therapist to talk about exercise and fitness and how that really may positively impact on doing well in the future. And they also see a social worker to really have a chance to process the experience. So it's a wonderful opportunity. It's available to patients who are treated at Yale and people anywhere in the community.
And in fact, I think that's the important aspect, that you view this clinic as really a resource, not only to patients here at Yale, but really to patients throughout the state of Connecticut and perhaps the local regional area.
Absolutely. And, in a sense, we're part of a network. I mean, there are a network of programs throughout the United States, each of us trying to learn what's the best way to provide this care and hopefully sending out a positive message of hope to cancer survivors.
So for those listening out there, Ken, how can they access some of the resources available here? And then maybe perhaps Julie can also repeat the website at the NCI.
Sure. Okay. They can. You can call 203-785 and then the word CARE, CARE, which really is 2273, or the Yale Cancer Center website. And but more globally, Julia, tell us.
Sure. Well, for information, if individuals are interested in pursuing more information about the Office of Cancer Survivorship, they can do it in one way by going onto the website to www.survivorship.cancer.gov. More generally, however, if they want more information on the vast array of educational materials that are available through the National Cancer Institute, they can also, if they're interested, pursue this by going on to the online to cancer.gov or calling the helpline that's manned by the National Cancer Institute, and that's 1-800, the number 4, and then spelling out the word cancer, 1-800-4-CANCER, for more information that might be appropriate to your needs across cancer care.
Thank you, Dr. Roland, and of course, thank you, Dr. Ed Chu and Dr. Ken Miller, your hosts. If you have questions for Dr. Roland or Dr. Chu or Miller, we encourage you to go to yalecancercenter.org. That's the website for more information about cancer and the resources available to you. You can listen to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers in audio and written formats as well. I'm Bruce Barber. This is the WNPR Health Forum. If you have any questions, of course, you can always go to our website at wnpr.org.